Okay, so thank you very much to Bob and Anne-Marie. This has been a lot of fun so far. So as you can see by this still image, there's a lot of olfactory processing that's going on here. The mouse has to know what's in its environment, and he has to know what that means to him, how he's going to respond. And so in this case, this guy decided to correctly to hold on to this food and ran away from the cat. So that's pretty predictable, and I can see this audience is like 80% guys. There's a lot of men here, and you're thinking, this is probably a guy mouse, right? He's making the right choice, he's in his environment, he's not being unpredictable. And I hope that we'll have a rational, a sensory explanation for why female behavior can be variable by the end of this talk. First, I'm going to give you a little introduction, so it takes a while to get to the female stuff, so stay awake. Okay, so as far as the what is in the environment and the how we respond to it, I think the textbook idea sort of follows this flow diagram. And that is just by basis of definition, the odor molecules themselves and the sensory receptors are encoding identity. And we think that largely this identity is maintained at the first relay. And this is a description of the vomeral nasal system, the accessory system that Ian was just talking about. So in the accessory olfactory bulb, we can imagine there's still identity that's being maintained. And then somewhere along the pathway, different types of information or neural ensembles are representing different things that are more emergent properties, such as the valence. Is this a good thing or a bad thing to the animal? And then also somewhere in the pathway, there needs to be some sort of decision making onto whether the animal should act on it. What's its past experience? What is its internal state? Is it hungry? Is it stressed? And all these things have to coincide in some sort of a decision making or command center. And then that has to inform motor, right? So from odor identity, it's not just a direct link to motor. There's these properties that have to be maintained. And my lab's really been looking at these, especially in terms of valence over the past few years, to try and understand how these different properties that act on the sensory information are encoded. In order to do that, over the last few years, we've identified a bunch of odor cues that stimulate the VNO so that there's stereotyped and reproducible responses to them. So these are special cues that don't have the learning aspect to them. As Gloria described earlier, these are things that are sort of pre-programmed or biased to have a higher probability of generating a predictable behavior. So cues that generate either rage or fear or attractive behaviors. And to just show you the strength of these cues or the power of these cues, I have a behavioral slide here. So here we found a cue many years ago that male mice emit, and it makes other guys angry. It fights them. So males live in small territories of one male, multiple females, multiple juveniles, and if another male comes into this territory, he has to sense them and fight him off. And so he does that through his vomeral nasal organ, through one of through his accessory system. And if we castrate a male, he doesn't make these sensory cues anymore. So these cues that make other guys know that he's there and know to fight him in his environment are testosterone dependent. And so if we just put a castrated intruder into this resident's cage, the resident is pretty calm. So this guy here is the resident, this is the intruder, and he really could care less about this guy here. He's just investigating his environment and kind of looking around. His body position is really neutral. He's super calm. But if we take these two mice and just 10 minutes later or so, we take the same two guys and take the same intruder and just paint a little bit of this cue that we isolated that's emitted from males. It's in their urine. It's a small protein. It's one of these high molecular weight things that we've talked about earlier. So it's called a major urinary protein or a MUP. And if we just make a synthetic version of it and paint it on the back of the intruder, this is the response to him. So it's really violent. This is nothing that the animal has to learn. Again, it's the same animal, so all the other environment has been controlled for in this. And the difference is just the little bit of this odor cue that's now on the back of this castrated guy. So the castrated guys not only don't make the outer cues, but they also don't respond aggressively to the male. So all that aggression you saw was directed just by the resident and not by the intruder. So that's sort of the power of these odor cues that these animals are emitting, and that's what we're interested in studying, decoding this circuitry. So that is ongoing, and understanding the logic of the neural ensembles in the brain is very complex, and so I'm not going to talk about any of that today, but you know, you guys may be wondering about female behavior. I am fascinated with male behavior. I have three brothers, and they're constantly confusing me. And so it struck us at one point, you know, why would males make a cue that makes other guys fight them? That's not smart, right? You could be stealthy and fight them, but to make a cue that provokes others, that makes no sense. And so after we isolated this cue several years, following that, Jane Hurst's lab had looked at those cues from a female perspective and realized very, very cleverly that females are very attracted to this cue. So the males are emitting this cue to attract the females like it, and it's worth that effort for them to, other males have co-opted the signal to generate aggression, and that little bit of fighting is worth it to attract the females. So that's what we think is happening here. And so now we have this single cue that when detected by males, it's eliciting this rage. And when detected by females, it's eliciting a positive valence behavior, this attraction. And so again, from a neural coding point, we're really interested in how the single sensory cue could morph in the two different gender brains to be able to turn into these really, really different behaviors. And we're interested in looking at that. However, this is actually a very difficult thing to study in the mammalian, in the mouse brain, because of the complexity of neurons. So if we're going to understand neural ensembles that are activated in males that lead to aggression, and those neural ensembles that are activated in females that are going to lead to this attraction, it's really hard to tell based on the differences in the heterogeneity of the nuclei that we believe are involved in the circuit, where these differences might occur if we're looking at it between different animals. Well, what we'd like to do is to be able to manipulate these differences in response to the sensory cue within the same animal. And so my postdoc started thinking about this problem, and Sandeepa decided that males and females are drastically different in the way that they respond to the world, but females can be different too. And that is that their behavior changes with regards to their ovulation cycle. So in the mouse, the ovulation cycle is called the estrus cycle. It's very rapid. It's occurring every 4 or 5 days. And over these 4 or 5 days, there's large changes that are occurring. Some of them are in the physiology, in the reproductive tract, their mammary gland, the secretions that they exhibit, even their hair and skin quality changes within these every 4 or 5 days. And it's well understood from behavioral studies that the behavioral response to the world changes as well. And so most good mouse behavioralists will really only use females that are staged in one behavior or the other, because these are they're so different. And so we wanted to know if there was an olfactory cue that we could peg to these changes in behavior, and therefore we could study how the behavior was changing in a single animal, a female, across the estrus cycle. And so we asked if this single cue that had been previously identified was one fit this notion. And that is, again, the lab that first identified it had staged all their females only in estrus, because normally in diestrus females don't do much, and they had never looked in diestrus. And so we simply wanted to know, does this cue still promote attraction during diestrus? And so we just did a simple two-choice test and asked whether the mouse in estrus and diestrus were attracted to it. And we were able to recapitulate the behavior that the Hurst lab had seen. So if we take either the native cue that I have listed here as HMW, or the synthetic cue that we made in lab, so again, this is the male rage cue, but if for females it's attractive, you can see that the females are attracted to it. They're above the zero line here, as Alyssa showed us before for the behavior. And if we look at the same females and their behavioral response in diestrus, they're completely indifferent. They could care less. They don't prefer it over water. They're just indifferent. And so this fit our need. We have something that's attractive promoting during estrus, and the mice are completely indifferent to it during diestrus. The response is changing over time. Okay, so So we know that female hormones are acting on the brain, and that these circuits that are thought to be downstream of the accessory olfactory processing feed into dimorphic circuits in the brain, the amygdala and the hypothalamus, that have expressed lots of steroid hormone receptor and modulatory receptors that are thought to be the targets of these sex-specific behaviors. And so we expected to be able to dive right into the brain and figure out the differences of how the female was responding and showing attraction to these cues during estrus and a difference during diestrus. But Sandeepa is extremely thorough, and she decided to just make sure, just to ask whether there were any differences going on in the sensory system itself before we dove into the more complicated brain. And so the question she wanted to ask was, is there any change in the sensory detection of this system across the estrus cycle? And so just to remind you, those of you that haven't seen this before, tell you guys the complexity of this system. Again, the vomeral nasal organ, it's this tube, and if you cut it like a pizza slice here, the ligands are, this is the lumen where the ligands are able to contact the sensory receptors. Their dendrites are poking this way towards this lumen. And all these different colors are, this is an image from the Dulac lab that shows that all the sensory neurons are slightly different. There's about 350 different kinds of sensory neurons throughout the accessory system. And we can go ahead and stimulate them, dissociate them, and prepare them from calcium imaging with calcium indicators, and then flow different stimulus over and see which ones respond. In a whole prepper by electrophysiology, it's hard to detect the precise nature of the response, and when they're dissociated like this, we can see it nice and easily. And we knew from experience in males that about 5% of these neurons had the receptor that would allow it to detect this particular pheromone cue. And so so how did the neurons respond over estrus and diestrus? So I've already showed you the behavior here, attracted during estrus, indifferent during diestrus. And when we look at the sensory neurons from females that were where their sensory neurons were gathered during estrus, we find that there is about this 5% of them are responding. But when we look in diestrus, this response is really attenuated. And that's shown here. So this correlates with the behavior. And the changes in the female internal state are largely driven by the ovaries. And so we could go ahead and remove the ovaries and ask, what's the default state of these females to respond to these cues? So I showed you in the last slide that during estrus they're responding, during diestrus they're attenuated, and the ovary-ectomized mice here in white, where we remove the ovaries first, you can see that the default response is to respond. So without any hormone signals, they're responding just like males, and something happens during diestrus to prevent that. And that's shown here. And across the estrus cycle, the ovaries are primarily producing two different female hormones, estrogen and progesterone. So estrogen surges largely during the estrus cycle, shown here in pink, and progesterone, P4, is surging more during and it's prolonged over during diestrus. And so we could take those ovary-ectomized mice that are where the default is to respond, and in our calcium imaging paradigm, we could just drop in physiological concentrations of these odor cues and ask, was anything sufficient to attenuate the response? And if we take the physiological concentrations of estrus produced during estrogen produced during estrus, or progesterone at the basal concentrations during estrus, we find that there's no effect of whether we add them to our prior to stimulation with the pheromone. But if we add the physiological concentrations of progesterone that occur during diestrus, we find that it attenuates the response, just like we had seen in the in vivo assay. And so this is a representation of the raw data that we have. And so you can see if we take these, each trace is a single neuron responding in our calcium imaging. So if we stimulate with the pheromone, it responds. We stimulate with the pheromone, it responds. We dump on the progesterone and wait just a short time, 10 or 15 minutes, and now add the pheromone and there's no response. And we know that these neurons haven't died because we can bypass the receptor and just activate the channel with the drug, and we find that the neurons are alive, they're able to respond, so the response is really attenuated. The response, it's just a modulation of the signal. And so this experiment was really exciting for us because it told us that the signal from the ovaries to the nose to tell the nose that the female is in diestrus is progesterone, and that this is occurring in a dish without neuronal signaling from the rest of the brain. It's not the central neurons in the brain that are getting the signal and telling the nose that it should respond differently. This is acting directly on the sensory neurons themselves. Okay, so there's kind of no precedent for this. We don't know how the sensory neurons could be sensing this sort of thing. The vomeral nasal organ has been implicated in sexual behavior for years, and people have looked for steroid hormones just for kicks, and nothing's ever been reported. And so we did RNA-seq, and we didn't see any of the classical steroid receptors, and most definitely not classical progesterone receptor. But we were really curious, you know, how could these guys be detecting progesterone? And our RNA-seq did find this expression of a non-classical membrane-associated receptor called progesterone receptor membrane component 1 that has been implicated in the detection of progesterone. And so we went ahead and did some immunolocalization with it. So if we take that sort of pepperoni slice that I showed you before, and we zoom in, this is antibody staining with the anti-PGRMC1, and you can find that it's really present in decorating the dendrites of many of these neurons, about 80% of these neurons. And we know this is specific because we were able to get a floxed version of PGRMC1 that we could specifically delete in the olfactory system. And when we delete that receptor, our staining goes away. So we think that this is really representative of the localization and the presence of the signal in these sensory neurons. So because we were able to knock this out just in the nose of the animal, these females still undergo an estrus cycle. They still do all sorts of cool behavioral changes. And so we were able to look at the function of this receptor in detecting and responding to these pheromone cues. And so in ex vivo, if we do this with the drug trick in the overactimized animals, I showed you previously that if they're overactimized, they're responding, and if you add progesterone, it's attenuated, but if you knock out this receptor just in the VNO, the default is to respond even in, is not to be attenuated, to not respond to the presence of progesterone in the environment. If we look at the naturally cycling animals, so these are not overactimized, we're not adding strange drugs exogenously, so just natively, I showed you that in estrus they respond, in diestrus it's attenuated, and without the receptor they're always responding. And when we do behavior of the whole animals, again, before in wild type animals, they respond, they're attracted during estrus, they're indifferent during diestrus, but if we knock out this receptor just from the nose, they're attracted all the time. And so that really links the ability of these sensory neurons themselves to sense this hormone and for it to change the behavior. Okay, so this was a nice surprise for us in that we can see that there were things happening right here at the periphery of the system. You know, things are still going on in the brain of these animals as they change from estrus to diestrus, but this is happening sort of upstream of that. So it's really a powerful way to monitor behavior. Now, I showed you that this PGRMC1 is on about 80% of the neurons, and the progesterone is throughout the body, so there's high levels of it for more than a day for this mouse. And so if this intersection between the hormone and the receptor is able to silence the sensory system, this could be a real problem for the female because the female VNO not only detects other males and other mice, but a big function of it is to detect predators and keep her safe in the environment. And if it's silenced every 4 days, she could be eaten, which would be another silly thing. That would be a bad thing. And so we wanted to know, is the detection of predator odors also silenced every 4 days? And the answer is no. So this is the calcium imaging of the neurons that from an estrus female and a diestrus female in response to a purified cat odor that we know causes is detected by VNO neurons, and you can see that it's a similar number is detecting this odor. It's not being changed by the female being in estrus. And we can look at the behavior, and you can see that both of these boxes are below the zero line. She's avoiding them, whether she's in estrus or diestrus. So, whew, she can detect the cat, she can respond appropriately to it. So there's something specific about the targeting of the male detecting sensory neurons that's occurring throughout estrus and diestrus that these predator detecting neurons are escaping. So again, I told you that this is in a lot of the sensory neurons, and so we were, Sandeepa postulated that there had to be some other sensory target that was special to the male sensory neurons that was going to allow them to be subjected to the silencing. And we knew just from some manipulations that we did that the receptor wasn't changing, and that drug experiment I showed you earlier showed us that the channel wasn't changing. It was there, it was intact in these male sensory neurons. And this is the rest of the signal transduction pathway as we know it in the VNO. It hasn't been well studied. And we know it's the pheromone receptor is a 7 transmembrane domain receptor. And there's G protein coupled signaling that activates a phospholipase C and goes ahead and gates this channel to cause the neurons to be active. And the identity of the PLC was done just using general PLC agonists and antagonists in the field, but it turns out that there's 14 variants of PLC in the mouse genome, all shown here. And when we did our RNA-seq on total VNO, we found that this variant here, PLC beta-4, is the one that's most highly expressed, but there's a little bit of a bunch of others, and then some trace of these other guys. But total VNO, remember, the VNO is super heterogeneous, and when we grind it up, we're not just getting sensory neurons, we're also getting other things. And so we did RNA-seq where we took our calcium imaging, and after we identified the neurons that are responding to the major urinary proteins, we pooled small groups of them, maybe 8 of them, and did RNA-seq just on those, so those target cells. And we found when we did that, that the PLC that was most enriched in those target cells is actually this version here, PLC beta-2, that's really low in our whole VNO. We were able to confirm this difference that we see by doing immunostaining. So this is antibodies. Again, this is sort of a zoomed in of this pizza slice here. And you can see there's only a few of these neurons here that are expressing PLC beta 2. And a knockout of this staining goes away. So again, we think that's real. But just because it's there in a small subset doesn't mean that it's actually doing the signaling. It could just be there as a decoration or to do something else that has nothing to do with primary signaling. So we wanted to know whether it was actually essential for the detection and response of the male pheromone. And indeed it is. So if we go ahead and we look at the neural activity by the calcium imaging, again, 5 to 6% of them respond in an intact animal, and that response almost completely goes away in the PLC beta-2 mutant. And the behavior also changes from being attracted during estrus to being indifferent during estrus. And we can see that's not the case in these mutant animals for the response, detection response to the cat odor. So in the mutant animals, they're still able to detect the cat odor, and they're still able to properly avoid the cat odor. And so that tells us something else that we didn't know before, and that is that it's not just the receptor that is making each of these sensory neurons have a specialized response to the environment, that there's also these signaling molecules, and in the mouse there's 14 PLC variants. This is in a subset of neurons that coincides with the male pheromone receptor. So these two are expressed together, and this is essential for this signaling. Okay, so we have these two different things, but what's special about PLC beta 2? Why would that necessarily give it the powers to silence these cells? So it turns out that the PLCs are highly modified by phosphorylation, which is just adding a phosphate group onto these molecules. And they're all different. Some of them get more active if they're phosphorylated, some of them don't change their activity at all, and some of them are less active. And it turns out that PLC beta 2 is dead if it gets phosphorylated on serines. So we did an IP, and we could look at the basal level of the serine phosphorylation. So just whether it is phosphorylated in a wild type animal without progesterone, so mimicking estrus, and you can see that there is no band here. It's not phosphorylated. But if we add progesterone, it is phosphorylated on these serines, so it's dead. And that if we get rid of this progesterone receptor, that phosphorylation goes away. So this is really consistent with a mechanism and why a rationale for why these neurons would go through the trouble of making not just a specialized receptor, but a specialized signaling target as well. It allows it the flexibility to be able to respond to the outside world in a way that makes sense to this receptor and this receptor signaling. Finally, we could see if this change in activity due to this phosphorylation is transferred to the representation in the brain. So if we just look at the first relay in the AOB, if we look at the estrus females, this is the AOB. These little dots are CFOS, and you can see along the stripe, which is what we expect the activity to be in a stripe like this if it's in response to a single cue. So in this stripe, you can see a number of green cells, and that number is attenuated. The pattern has changed. The representation has changed in the brain. And these are in wild-type animals going from estrus to diestrus. So this correlates with our change in the behavior and probably helps to account for that change in behavior. Okay, so briefly, I want to tell you, so you're thinking, okay, this is fine, but it's in the VNO, and it's females, and this is a weird thing, and that's all nutty. Should I remember this for the future? Is this important? And the question is, yeah, we think that this is a general property of the olfactory system, the ability to modulate it at the periphery. And so we have since been playing. We see all sorts of cool little hormone receptors in sensory neurons, and one of the paradigms we're looking at is the response to stress. And you can see in non-stressed animals, if we get, and these are males, pay attention. So in non-stressed animals, they are responding to female urine here. And if we stress them by giving them a 5-minute restraint, you can see that response is really attenuated, shown here. And if we stain for activated neurons in the VNO, you can see that staining is diminished if we give them stress first. So the number of neurons that are activated, we can do it in vitro and in vivo. Moreover, we see these hormones in the MOE. And so if we go ahead and look at the response, that same paradigm, that stress paradigm in males in the MOE, we can see a good response to male urine. It's attenuated in the stressed animals, and that corresponds with the in vivo activity labeling as well. So overall, what I told you is that general flow model that I had of sort of going from identity culminating in a decision command center is likely to not be completely correct. And that the sensory neurons themselves are not only encoding identity, but in some ways they're also doing decision making by virtue of having the ability to monitor the internal state of the animal and decide whether or not they should pass on the information to the brain. We think that it is very odd that the sensory system, it's both odd and cool that the sensory system would be tasked with this, because it's an absolute system. If you don't pass the information along to the brain can never act on it. So from a female's point of view, I was thinking, this is crazy, you know? I mean, you want to get all, the sensory system should be vacuuming up all the cues from the environment, passing them along, and letting the brain make that decision. But instead here, the sensory system, it's the executive center. It's deciding not to pass on the signal. The female doesn't even know the male's out there. She could never act on it. So how that would occur so high in the process, the rationale for keeping it there, I'm not sure. But if any sensory system is going to be able to do this, the olfactory system is perfect for it because it's a chemodetector, and most of the things that tell about internal state are chemical molecules that can be sensed and signaled. So you can imagine that in ancient, more simpler systems, you know, having these integrated into one single cell was extremely powerful. So we think this is a general property of olfactory systems, and Jing Wang has already showed that the flies' olfactory sensory neurons are also modulated by hunger state, directly modulated by hunger state. So I think that's more evidence that that this is something that's occurring, and that if we want to be able to study decision making and coding deep in the brain, if we can get a better handle on what's happening that's leading to this variability at the periphery, whether an animal is stressed, whether it's mated, whether it's whatever, we can control that at the periphery. I think we're going to be able to understand and control and study what's going on deep in the brain circuits a lot easier too. So we're really excited about this. So this was started by a postdoc when he was in my lab many years ago, and then sort of dropped for a long time, and I had a great postdoc that came and followed it up almost completely by ourselves, Sandeepa Day. And we did this, we got the PGRMC1 knockout mice from these guys, and Hiro Matsunami really helped us with the single cell, the small group of cell RNA-seq that was really valuable to us. So thank you.
That's an incredible talk. Thank you so much for that. That was great. The other high progesterone state that I know of is pregnancy itself.
Yes.
Can you just speculate on what possible roles would have in pregnancy, and the kind of, I guess the part B of that question is, in humans, right, pregnancy is thought to induce qualitative changes of perception in females. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. So this seems like a really, like, there's just a lot of evolution that has to go into this system in the females to be able to not respond to a male cue. Her brain's always already telling her not to mate with the male, so why gate the signal just not to be attracted? So we don't really think that the function of this is to prevent attraction to males. That seems silly. It's just something that we were able to see in the lab. And so why would it go through all this trouble? And pregnancy is a really good option. I mean, I think it must have something to do with the viability and the long. I mean, that's the type of thing that would allow it to be stabilized in the genome. So we are starting to look at Bruce. We have not looked at it in these knockout animals, the Bruce effect that Ian had talked about earlier, to see if there's any sort of link with that. But beyond that, it's sort of hard for us to speculate why the female may be doing that in this particular situation. So there's anecdotal evidence that human females change their olfactory preferences and sensitivity based on either their ovulatory cycle or whether they're pregnant or not. It's hard for me to judge whether that's true or not. What I can say is that we do see PGRMC1 in the human MOE. So, and as we do all sorts of other fabulous hormone things, so I kind of think that what the mouse is doing, that it could be, again, a general property of the olfactory system. It's, you know, whether that thing that we see in the human MOE is doing anything or not, you know, that's going to be a little hard to test.
What happens when the animal re-enters estrus? You said that these receptors are phosphorylated. Are they dephosphorylated? You said, also said they were done. Or do you develop new cells with new receptors?
You don't. The cells remain there. And the progesterone receptor isn't phosphorylated itself. It just starts the signaling cascade. It's a kinase that starts, oh, I don't know if I said that. It's a kinase that starts the signaling cascade. But the PLC beta 2, it's phosphorylated and it turns over. So this is another thing. This is a really rapid action signaling that we can do in addition 10 minutes. Usually hormone signaling is sort of, you know, it's transcriptional over an hour or two, and you know, this is very rapid, and it doesn't fit the kinetics of the estrus cycle per se. So we think that it's sort of these tools and this behavior that allowed us to see this, but that this isn't specific just to these cells. It's just a function of being able to link hormones to specific signaling pathways. And we think that other types of behavior, such as the stress, that may be a reason why you need this rapid action and not such a delayed thing.
I was just wondering, this is a little bit unrelated, but just off the top of your head or from your reading the literature, Is cell type specificity of receptor signaling pathways conferred by a specific phospholipase C isoform? Is that something that we should sort of, do you think that's fairly common in the nervous system? Is that something that, you know, one should keep an eye out for?
You know, I think that we know very little about how, we know that modulation is silencing neurons, but I don't think we know a lot about the molecular mechanism of how this is occurring. And this sort of mechanism is super easy. There's a lot of flexibility to it, so I could see that other centers in the nervous system could be using something similar, this sort of rapid action signaling, to be able to affect neural activity, but I don't think we have a general idea of how most modulatory hormones are actually changing the output behavior of sensory neurons. So this is a nice little model.
So Lisa.
Yeah.
So the phosphorylation of PLC beta 2, I would imagine it will change the sensitivity or the dose response. Have you tried a dose response to see if it's simply shift or is it all or none effect? And the second question is, how have you tried to do recovery and see how fast it can recover from the progesterone stimulation?
Right. So for the second question, we have not done that in vitro because our cells are sort of, you know, they're on their way out. They've been ripped from the nose of the animal, so we haven't done that. Right. We haven't done a time course of recovery. We just know that it is present and functional during estrus and not during diestrus, and that it can be shut off rapidly. And the first question, I've lost all. The dose response. You know, I can't recall that we did that. I don't think that we actually did do that. This response, so it's attenuated. There's always a few cells that escape it, and you can see there's some signaling to the brain. And so we don't know whether that's differential molecular features of the individual cells or whether it's just changing the probability, and if we were to go up higher. You know, we use these things are present in the environment at high concentrations, 20 mg per mil in the urine, and we use them at, you know, for this, it's like a 1 to 300 dilution, so it's pretty concentrated to begin with. We're using them at the high effective rate on a native tissue, so I don't think we've tried to go higher.
I was wondering whether we should think of this as being like other examples of, you know, almost active sensing, right? So we have efferents that go to our ears that actually change the mechanics of the cochlea. Obviously, we only see the things we're looking at, right? We only get tactile information from the things we touch. So it, you know, you presented it, for reasons I think I understand, as being part of this very specific set of behaviors. But I guess the question is hormonal modulation of receptor cell responses just one more way in which we can actively control the information that we take in, and we should see it as being of a piece with these other things, which also are on odd timescales? And
yeah. So I think this differs very much from some of the other things. I think some of the other sensory systems, you know, I don't know of any sensory system that's specifically gating a specific type of activity. So think of when you're in a crowded room, the cocktail party phenomenon, right? You're focusing on the person that you're talking to, and you can have a conversation with them even in a loud environment, but somebody else calls your name far away, and all of a sudden you attend to it, right? So everything's getting in, but you're filtering it all out unless it has specific meaning, like your name. And whereas in this case, stuff just isn't getting in. So this, I think, the analogy to me is like, you know, if you are, you see a buffet of food, you eat a hamburger, you're now full of a hamburger, the buffet still has hamburgers, and you can see the whole buffet, but you can't see the hamburgers anymore, right? Like that's not expected of the visual system. That selectivity is not expected of the other sensory systems. It's kind of, it doesn't even make sense, right? But yet, I think that's what's happening here.
If I activate the efferents that go to this part of the cochlea, not that part of the cochlea, then I'll have an impact on the information that I take in one frequency band and not another.
Right, but that's the brain making an executive decision back in, right? Oh. That's not the sensory system saying you don't get a choice. And I think that's the difference, is that, I mean, I think that's how we would think that it would work, that there could be gain modulation, right, to the olfactory system based on whether you're hungry or not. But in this case, it's not, there is no feedback from the brain. It's not the brain deciding that you should pay attention to it or not, or that you, right? It's the nose saying, you don't get to choose. I'm just not going to give you that information.
The choice was made by the release of the hormones, right?
That was a great talk. I guess going back to this question is, what's the behavioral outcome of not having this PLCB2 positive neurons? Do these females stop mating? I understand they are not attracted to this particular, right? What happens if you don't see the burger in the buffet?
Right. So they're not attracted to it, which is what I showed you. But we also, we did look at, you know, if they're, right, the opposite, without the PGRMC1, so if they can't, so without the PLC beta 2, they don't see it, right? So they're not attracted, they won't mate, right? But if you don't have the progesterone receptor in the nose, the animals are still cycling, so they'll go into estrus. And during estrus, they're not attracted, during diestrus, they are now attracted to it, but yet they still won't mate. Their brain still knows, right? So this sort of goes back to Bob's question of, you know, why do this? Why gate this information? And I think it's just part of, I think it's just a sign of sort of all the flexibility that's happening in the system, and that this can be used for other things, not specifically for the attraction. The brain is still doing the brain-regulated things that hormones do. It's just that there's this other level of control that's on top of it now.
Lisa, it was a great talk. To follow up on what Bob asked before, do you think that you are maybe only seeing the tip of the iceberg by looking at estrus? And if you looked at pregnancy and did your RNA-seq, you might get a whole host of markers that are different in a progesterone-dependent way.
Yeah, so we've done RNA-seq on pregnant female VNOs, and we don't see much difference. Right. So, and this isn't a transcriptional difference. This is a this is protein modification here. So, yeah. So I don't know. You know, I don't know where in the pregnancy. You know, I mean, because it is. It's very dynamic, and things are changing. And I don't know when we did that or how we did that. But we didn't. We were hoping for some cool low-hanging fruit and got nothing.
I was wondering whether you're seeing a correlation between receptor expression, PLC beta and progesterone receptor within the neurons. In other words, whether any receptor can come with its complement of signaling pathways, or whether the receptors sort of fall into classes that come with specific signaling pathways, which has implications for the sorts of questions, I guess. That,
yeah, you know. So it looks like this PLC beta 2 variant is specific to these MUP receptor expressing neurons and not in the other ones. When we do in situ for the other PLC variants, there's all these fabulous patterns. So some of them are salt and pepper like this, some of them are only apical, others are only basal, some are all over. There's a huge variety. And so it makes me think that you could use these modules, could be interchangeable, and based on what we see here with the MUP detecting receptors, this male pheromone detecting receptors, that is likely to be genetically determined, that these things are coming in a package that makes sense to the animals. And then there is this PLC beta, or this PGRMC1, which is, for some reason, is in a lot of the neurons. We see it in the male neurons as well, so it's either there or it's doing something, I don't know. But then we also see a lot of other different hormone receptors in the olfactory sensory neurons. And so you could imagine that there are these genetic modules that are coming together and are predetermined to do stuff that makes sense to the animal. You know, in the VNO, you can follow that logic. In the MOE with associative behavior, I'm not sure where that logic is going to get us and how that's going to work, but there's stuff to play with if the stress response is going on there, so we'll check it out.
Lisa, so I'm wondering if there's a way to do that. I think, you know, people like Tim Holley presumably can do these experiments. If you take, let's say, 100 VNOs, from, you know, different times, random times, and large number of odors, and if you try to look for sort of the population coding, they should be wildly variable if this phenomenon is, you know, extensive.
Do you have a sense for that, or maybe Tim can comment on this as
well? Right. We don't have enough ways to say which neuron is responding in the VNO. So we don't have enough tags on them. So if we go for 100 VNOs, we may see slight differences in numbers of neurons that are responding, but it's really hard for us to tell the identity of them. Right. And part of this is the choosing odors, right, that are going to make sense. So when we look at, and I didn't show you guys this, if you look at total urine in females between estrus and diestrus, it's the same. The response, the calcium imaging response is the same, which is why nobody's ever seen this. So it's just the response to MUPS that changes, and what we see is that there's this other type of molecule, these low molecular weight volatile molecules, and the response to those actually goes up during diestrus. So the net is a wash. So there's another population. We don't know what the ligands are. We just know that they're in urine. They're doing the other thing. And so if you're to take a bunch of stimuli and you sort of mush them together in pools, so it's picking the right stimuli and then looking over those 100 animals, and we're trying to figure out logical ways to do that based on, you know, with the stress response, what would they want to smell when they're stressed versus not want to smell when they're stressed? And so we're just sort of making these guesses that may not be right.
Lisa, I don't know if you mentioned this, but is the non-canonical progesterone receptor or the PLC beta 2, are they expressed at all in male?
Yes, they are.
OEs?
They both are, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so that PGR, that non classical progesterone receptor is expressed at the same level in the male neurons, and we don't know what that means right now. It's either there because it just doesn't hurt to be there, or this thing is actually, until really recently, it actually wasn't even implicated in binding progesterone. It was associated with some undiscovered, uncharacterized progesterone receptor, and so it's been implicated in binding other things as well, and so it's possible that it's also detecting other cues that may be relevant to the male, or it may just be there because it doesn't hurt the male.
I wonder if one piece of the puzzle is how males are using the MUP, because Wayne Potts has suggested that the MUP is like you said, it's 20 mg per mil. It's incredible metabolic cost to produce this, and that this is, if you look up the amount is produced over a year, it's equivalent of a deer growing antlers or a peacock growing a tail, and that it's an honest signal for male-male competition. So if that was true, then females should be very sensitive to the amount a male is producing. I wonder, in a lab, maybe males are always producing a high amount, but in under natural circumstances, a male, you know, if it's hungry or something, is going to be producing less. And I wonder if that might explain some of the modulation. It's just a thing as a sexually selected signal.
We do see that males produce different amounts of MUPS, same repertoire, but different amounts based on whether they're dominant or subordinate or things like that, right? It will change. The response to them occurs, it occurs over a wide concentration range, and I don't think that's what we're seeing here. And in this case, you know, we've got it's very artificial, the conditions we're using. We're using a set amount of these at a set concentration, and the response really does vary with the female's progesterone levels.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you. So I'd like to thank all the speakers. Is that what you said? Okay, thank all the speakers.